That's what I think we're starting with McManus on top of it. I should know it's the last one.
Oh, well.
I just glanced over. I think everybody did pretty well. I just glanced over. We're talking about John Calvin on page 42 of our syllabus. John Calvin in Geneva. And that's another very long paragraph I give you there. It's sort of a very strange way to do business, but that's the way they did it. Geneva began to present itself as a model city, a theocratic society of the elect, a Christian society. And let me emphasize how this way of thinking is so important to American history. The Puritan fathers of the New England colonies had as their goal the establishment of a model Christian society. That was what they wanted to do, among other things. Why? Because, you see, Europe was overburdened. Europe was hopelessly polluted or hopelessly given over to this church-state system. But America was a new, in the colonies, everything was new, it was fresh, boundless opportunities, no old institutions to overcome, and that was their idea. Now, let me point out that it didn't work in Geneva, and it didn't work for very long. It didn't work in America for very long.
Why?
Because of this fundamental Calvinistic, it's the fundamental flaw in Calvinistic soteriology, or the theory of salvation. See, if you believe that salvation is the miraculous reversal of the will, which is the fundamental point in Protestant conversion, then you have to believe, or you tend to believe anyway, you should believe, logically you're forced to believe, that once a person is saved, then they will tend to do the right. Understand that? They will tend, if to use the language of the Westminster Confession of Faith, if there is this miraculous, quote, disposition toward God, or disposition to do the will of God, then you should have men doing the right. And of course, it is not biblical theology that men, that salvation is not a miraculous reversal of the will. The biblical doctrine is repentance, where man, in the face of persuasion, in response to persuasion, changes his own mind. The moral decision, not a miraculous transformation. Well, you see, but they couldn't figure out why men would not do the right once they were saved. And of course, we know that the biblical view of man is, don't turn your back on him, eventually he'll get you. The man is lost, he's a sinner. You understand that? And it was much more complicated than that. Well, but this idea of being a model, Calvin, and here we owe a great debt to John Calvin. John Calvin established a complete system of education. The ministry of the church was responsible for it. The university was founded. Listen to me, the idea of universal public education is a Christian idea. That is, it came from the church. And this is why in Western civilization, this is a Western civ course, Western civilization, education has been bestowed upon a society by the historic church. That's why I get so upset when these modern secularists, I had this little discussion on television with this head of the Atheist Association, and he was very indignant, and I was talking to Jim Hooker, the ACLU man, they were very indignant that that Christians would want to have a direct say in the public schools. And I told the fellow on television, we believers, we Christians feel very badly about this, because you see, if it weren't for the church, you wouldn't have any schools. There are our schools, we have them first. There's a public, you understand that? The public education, the American, in Western Europe, in America, the public education system that you have came to the church. As did the university system, as did the hospital system, as did all benevolent institutions, as does the theater, interestingly enough. Do you know that? Modern theater has been taken over by the pornographers to a great deal. They x-rated that crowd, but it started with the church. That is, you would not have very much in society without the church. Well, Calvin, why? Well, if you're going to have people, who are going to carry on and make possible this theocratic society of the elect, then you've got to have people who are informed. Let me say, that was the thinking of the founding fathers of our country. They were very deeply affected by this. Why should there be education? The founding fathers wanted freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and they wanted to promote education. And they wanted to promote religion and education. Any question about it? The idea that the religion should not be in the public school system is a very new idea. It's very unconstitutional, and it's very absurd. Why? Because you see, if you're going to, and they thought it was the same thing. If you're going to have a democracy, that means the people rule, right? That's what the word means, the rule of the people. But what's going to happen to your state, to your society, if the majority of the people are ignorant, selfish, and or immoral? Then you're going to have an ignorant, selfish, immoral state. So if you're going to have democracy, you've got to have what our founding fathers called moral education. And you've got to have people who are informed. You've got to have a democracy. To have a police state, if you're going to have a police state, then the less educated the people are, the better off you are. The less they know, the more animalistic they are, the easier they are to control. But if you're going to have a democracy or a republic, to be technically correct, a republic where people are going to vote and their vote means something, then you've got to have people who are of high stature, who are moral and advanced. Otherwise, the thing won't work. And this is the very reason why Calvin promoted what we would call today public. Well, for instance, we see in America what is happening. Why is the government growing every year? Well, in the very recent times, why has the welfare state exploded since the days of Roosevelt? I'll tell you why. Because you have enough voters who will vote themselves what they have not earned. If you get enough people who will vote themselves what they have not earned, that is, if I have the right by electing certain people, holding certain policies, to vote to myself what you own. Got that? If I vote myself what you own, if that goes on long enough and expands far enough, you'll destroy a society. Why? Because why should I work and be honest and save if you can vote, if all you have to do is vote yourself my bank account? And so the idea is I'm saying that everything is degraded. Well, this is what they were. Any questions on that? I don't want to go too far afield. But this is what is going on. And I want us to see that this way of thinking, because of the Puritans, because it was the Puritans, these were Calvinists. You talk about Calvinists. The Puritans who founded the New England colonies and had so much impact on the foundational documents of our country were Calvinists. In some cases, they were more Calvinistic than Calvin was. Now, did everybody go along with this? No. Many rejected Calvin's control. A libertine party was formed in opposition to Calvin in Geneva. And he had a lot of trouble. But word spread, a lot of outsiders came to Geneva. What happened was that a lot of people who agreed with Calvin came to town, and they in effect took over Geneva, were about to. The native Genevans, who didn't like Calvin, a lot of them, they found themselves being outvoted because of all these outsiders who came just because Calvin was there. So obviously they were going to go along. It's kind of like what happened to Antelope, Oregon, when the Bob Sheesh came in. They simply moved in a lot of people and changed the name of the town and took over, because everybody registered to vote, and took over the town. Until the government got rid of Bob Wan and his Rolls Royces. Which Calvin didn't have any Rolls Royces, but Calvin was not very popular. And he received, in this, where outsiders were coming in because of Calvin and gaining the majority, Calvin received warning notes. People set their dogs on him. He walked down the street, they'd throw garbage at him out of the windows of the houses. He had a great time in Geneva. Then, and briefly I mentioned in the top of page 43, the unfortunate and infamous encounter between Calvin and Michael Servetus. Michael Servetus was a brilliant Spaniard. He discovered or guessed the principle of the circulation of blood long before Harvey did. You understand, it was Harvey who enunciated the principle of the circulation of blood. Michael Servetus figured this out a long time before Harvey did, but nobody paid attention to Servetus. He was a Unitarian, not a native Jew, he was an unbeliever. He was a Spaniard who was practicing medicine in France. Well, and finally, and he bitterly attacked Calvin. And but finally, even the Roman Catholic Church in France declared Servetus a heretic, which he really was by their standard. He believed in God, but he denied the deity of Christ. And anyway, he'd been having this fight with Calvin through the mail, through letters. And when he had to leave France, he went to Geneva. And nobody's been able to figure out why. It was a suicide complex or something. It has been suggested that he knew that Calvin was in trouble, and Calvin was hanging on by his toenails in Geneva. They have thought if he showed up, he could tip the scales and maybe get rid of it. But note this, he was just as much a heretic to the Roman Catholics as he was to the Calvinists or to the Protestants who weren't in Geneva. In the case of Geneva, he was just as much a heretic to, but he was a heretic to everybody. Not just those who, not just the Calvinists, not just the followers of Calvin. And so he came, he was arrested as a heretic in Geneva, and Calvin was the prosecuting attorney, but he was the leading minister in the city. The council opposed Calvin, but they condemned Servetus to death, even though he didn't like Calvin. Why? Because they could not side with somebody who denied the deity of Christ. Calvin asked for a beheading, but the council settled on burning, and Calvin went along with it. Keep in mind, burning, as we've already learned, was the standard. Sometimes they want to be merciful to a heretic. They would strangle them before they would burn them. They would be dead. If they were a particularly bad heretic, they would burn them alive. Calvin, to his credit, wanted them to behead Servetus, but the council followed the standard procedure and burned him. Calvin, of course, approved of all this. But interestingly enough, the city council, for a short time before they began to think clearly about it, they considered for a short time siding with Servetus against Calvin. Then they realized they couldn't, but because they'd even considered it, the people in the city heard about it and voted them out. And Calvin, therefore, interesting, Servetus did Calvin a favor by coming, although he didn't plan it that way. Y'all see that? Because of this temporary lapse, that is, the town council even considered going along with Servetus, they were voted out, and Calvin, the enemies of Calvin were voted out. Well, look at my last statement there, in that paragraph. Although he never held public office, he was the uncrowned monarch of Geneva. Interesting, Calvin ruled Geneva with an iron hand, but he never held a civil office. He was simply a minister. Well, I give us here, in summary, the influence of Calvin. I've already talked about most of this, so we'll move very quickly. He became the second generation leader of the Reformation. Luther, of course, was the first. His institutes went through several editions into nine languages before 1630. International Protestantism was enunciated by the Institutes of the Christian Religion by John Calvin, not Luther's works. You must know that. All belief only Protestant, all Protestantism is based on the theology to one degree or another of John Calvin. He inspired in part modern democracy, in part. He inspired in part modern education. I've talked about that. He inspired in part modern capitalism. And I've talked about that, have I not? Well, that's a almost breathtaking, isn't it? Like that one man had that much influence. Well, We now return to the reform movement in France. We have looked at the reform movement in Swiss-speaking Switzerland with Zwingli, in French-speaking Switzerland with Calvin. Now we look at the reform movement in France. And what does it say right now? This is a bloody story. France, and keep in mind, was the first country in Europe to centralize power. That is, you had a king of France who could really be called the king of a nation. Before, you had a king in Spain or England who could really be, in the full sense of the term, spoken of as the king of a nation. And France, as you remember, in the Babylonian captivity, the church we studied last quarter, where the French took the papacy to Avignon for about 70 years. To understand what's going on now, you must understand that France, the monarchy, the throne, Louis XIV and the others, they had a vested interest in the Roman Catholic Church. They wanted a state church, they wanted a Roman Catholic. Why? Because the French monarchy controlled the Roman Catholic Church in France. Therefore, regardless of any writing that Calvin might do, you recall the institutes were addressed to the French king, to the French monarchy. Regardless of any pleadings that could be made, the French monarchy could not tolerate anything that would threaten the monolithic structure of French Catholicism. And what was threatening the monolithic structure of French Catholicism? The answer is Protestantism. You must understand that. Because in Germany, there was no centralized power at all, so Luther lived and wrote. Okay? In Switzerland, we looked at Germany, we looked at Switzerland. In Switzerland, Zwingli could turn Zurich into a Protestant city. Calvin and Farel coming first, could turn Geneva into a Protestant city. Nobody to stop them. Why? They were part of the whole Roman Empire. Besides, this was Switzerland. They were in their mountain fastness. They were easily defensible. That is, what I'm saying is this, that one of the reasons that the Reformation took root and grew in Germany and in Switzerland was that there was no central monarchy, central power that was able to wipe it out. You recall Philip of France, of Spain, the king of the whole Roman Empire tried to in the 30 Years' War. Despite the efforts, horrible slaughter, that terrible page in the history of Western civilization, yet they could not wipe it out. But things were different in France. There was this very strong centralized power. Okay, we look at in these years, 1522 to 1559, the appearance of the reform movement in France and its growth. The influence of Luther was felt within 5 years after he nailed the theses to the church door at Wittenberg. It was Calvin's theology, however, not Luther's, as I've already said, which became the theological focus in France. Francis I, the king, persecuted the Protestant movement in the interest of national unity. He was also a convinced Roman Catholic. What I'm saying is that the motive for the severe persecution of Protestantism in France, the primary motive was not religious, it was political. But the religious motive was very much there. He issued an edict against blasphemy. Henry II, his son, intensified it. This edict against blasphemy, by blasphemy he meant Protestantism. There were a number of laws against heresy. A whole new court was created just to try and put to death Protestants. You got that? A whole new court system was formed just to deal with the Protestants in France. Hundreds were burned alive, tortured, left to die. Large numbers fled, as Calvin had done earlier. The name Huguenot, now learn this, came to be applied to French Protestants. What is a Huguenot? It's a French Protestant. Listen to me, nobody knows where that name came from. It's lost in history. There are myths. You'll find some books that will try to make a guess, but we simply do not know why they were called Huguenots. That information is not. It's one of those things where, because everybody then knew, nobody bothered to write it down. And we now do not know. Even by their enemies, the Huguenots were noted for their uprightness of life and courage in the face of persecution. Persecution went on. The Protestant movement grew. Despite the persecution, the first church was organized in 1555. By 1559, there were 72 churches with over 2,000 regular, what they call conventicles, or meetings, assemblies. Listen to me. 1/10 of the population, 1 out of 10 in France, became Protestant. Now keep in mind, the Catholic Church in France was very corrupt. The Catholic Church in France was royally hated by a lot of the common people. And this came to the fore later in the French Revolution, where Catholic priests were beheaded by the hundreds, and church officials in general. Yet that 1 in 10.
The people then, for the most part, did not join the Protestant movement out of theological reasons.
So the people did. Well, yes, but what I'm saying is that the monarchy had for so long used the church to suppress the people that there was not this great emotional tie to the Roman Catholic Church as there might have been. Let me say this the way I want to say it. There was not this strong emotional tie on the part of many people, not everyone, to the Roman Catholic Church as we might expect, France being Catholic for so long. Does that make sense to you? There's a lot of reasons, but listen closely to Protestant theology. Now think of that, 1 out of 10. And this year, the National Reformed Church was organized with a Presbyterian form of government. We've already talked about that last quarter. An ascending series of courts under the bishops. A confession of faith was drawn up, and they, despite the terrible persecution, the Protestant movement moved on in France. Now, if you want to read something about some of these persecutions, just go to Fox's Book of Martyrs, and it tells many individual stories of the suffering of the Huguenots. Quite interesting. Then war broke out in France, as it had in Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, but not to the extent, of course. For most of this period, France was ruled by Catherine de Medici. She granted the Huguenots the right to worship outside the cities. However, a fanatic Roman Catholic family called the Guise family, G-U-I-S-E, they were fanatic. Now, these were Roman Catholics. They were devout. They were loyal to the Pope. And they did everything. They were a very powerful family in France. And they did everything they could to limit or to remove the freedoms that had been granted to the Protestants. They could meet, understand, they couldn't meet in the city. They could meet outside the cities, granted by Catherine de Medici. And so the terrible massacres began. And one of these massacres were, in some sense, illegal. Huguenot worshippers are massacred, and a series of wars began. That is, the Huguenots began to fight back. This was the way they did it back then. There were 8 wars altogether. Remember the small colic wars we studied? Very complex. Roughly the same thing. Very complex. They would make treaties and truces, and they would be broken. After 3 inconclusive wars, a truce was broken by the infamous Massacre of St. Bartholomew, August 24th, 1570. St. Bartholomew's Massacre, one of the big days in French history. I'll give you the date there, August 24th, 1572. What happened was that Huguenot leaders had been given safe conduct to attend a royal wedding in Paris. It was a trick. So they invited the leaders, and listen to me, in France, many of the leaders of the Huguenot were some of the leading people in France. Many of the most powerful, some of the most wealthy people in France, some of the most important people in France, influential people in France, became Protestants. So their leaders, 8,000, as many as 8,000, were invited to this royal wedding. When they got there, they closed the gates and massacred them. The government thought, the king thought that that's how, the Guise family was behind this, thought that's how they could, a good way to stop the Protestant movement was to kill the leaders. Think about that. And then war broke out again. As many as 70,000 in all were murdered, the Huguenots. 5 more wars were fought. Finally, in 1598, the Edict of Nantes, kind of like the Peace of Westphalia in Germany, guaranteed limited toleration to cities which were strongholds of Huguenot strength. Now, this didn't hold very well. Page 45, I give a woodcut of the St. Bartholomew's Eve massacre. But We look at Protestantism under the edict of Nantes, 1598 to 1685, and I make this statement here in the syllabus I want to talk about a little bit, that the treatment of Protestants in France, especially, as well as other parts of Europe, were very much had a tremendous impact on the thinking of those who established the American colonies. I keep making this connection, but I want us to see this. Days was a Roman Catholic colony. That was Maryland, the original colonies. Maryland was Roman Catholic. Roman Catholics were excluded from other colonies for the most part, and there was a genuine hatred of Roman Catholicism in early American thought. This carried through, was still carried through. It is, it's interesting. The Ku Klux Klan represents white, Anglo-Saxon Protestantism, not Catholicism. There was a genuine, when John F. Kennedy was elected, there was a big hoopla. Some of us, y'all can't remember, but when John F. Kennedy was elected, there was a big hoopla about having a Roman Catholic in the White House. And the saying back in America in the 19th century was, no, when the Irish immigration came in, the Irish Catholics immigrated by the thousands to America, there came a saying into the American vernacular, no Irish need apply. They've got newspapers. They were advertising jobs, there were jobs available, they put no Irish need apply. Why? I'm not going to hire Catholics. And there has been a tremendous amount of prejudice, I would say, against Catholicism in the thought of early America. Now, it is going by the boards now. You don't find that so much now. But even when I was a little boy, I could remember a lot of it. And where did it come? Especially France. What I'm saying to you is that the treatment of the Protestants by the Roman Catholic Church in France led to a real fear and hatred for Roman Catholicism in the founding of early America. So the Roman Catholics were considered second-class citizens, they were not wanted. And this also is one of the reasons why our founding fathers wrote into the Constitution the separation of, not of church from state, but the separation of the federal state from a state church. It was not the separation of religion from public institutions, as the modern Supreme Court has illegally said. You got that? They did not want a federal state church. A federal church, you would say. By the way, many of the colonies, which were to be states, when all this was put together, had their own state church. They didn't care about that. They get rid of those later. But they, you know, what they all is the federal government from having an official church that's supported by taxes and becomes an agency of government. And one of the reasons why our founding fathers did not want a church system to be an agency of the government is that they remembered what happened in France. Does that make sense to you? If you read their writings, they talked about this. They referred to this. Very real to them. And especially when a lot of the people who came to America fled persecution that was sponsored by the Roman Catholic Church. So, what I'm saying is this. Was this early fear of and hatred for Catholicism in early American thought, was it simple blind prejudice? The answer is no. It often took the forms of prejudice, and it created a prejudice, but it was grounded in some pretty hard experience, some pretty tough history. And modern Roman Catholic historians will admit that. They wouldn't admit it back then, but they admit that now. Any questions on that? Okay, we're all now quiet. Louis XIV, who was known for his furniture, Louis XIV was a powerful king, and his kingsville, a pretty good one, pretty efficient. came to America, came to the colonies, fleeing this. You get some families who come to America, and the reason that they come to the New World is because the church was going to take their kids away from them and raise them Catholic. You can see what they're coming to be in America is a pretty strongly anti-Catholic sentiment. And when this happened to their parents and their grandparents. Well, men were sent into galley slavery. What's galley slavery? To row the boats. They had some that were rowed, still rowed back in, not the big ocean, but they still rowed. Some of them. The borders of France were sealed. Huguenots couldn't get out. Many did. It's hard to seal borders. Think about that. They keep them in. France became legally a prison for Huguenots. Protestantism was heavy in the middle classes. And this caused a real problem for France because remember I said the Protestants tended to be the best people? People who had businesses, who controlled money, and it hurt France. Many of the best people from France came to America. Let me say this to you, that there came out in the 60s and 70s. Because the leaders of the American Revolution were not the proletariat, they were the landowning aristocracy. But one of the reasons why, listen to me, one of the reasons why the American experiment worked, this experiment of freedom, when nobody thought it would work, one of the reasons why America pulled it off against all odds was that that very many of the people who came to get the thing going from England and from France were some of Europe's best people. You understand that? Some of Europe's. France lost some of its best people to America. England lost some of its best people to America. Why? People of high religious conviction, people of education, people of influence, people with. They would transport their criminals to America, and a lot of indentured workers came, so there was not. But I'm saying there were a lot of the people in America who came who were of the lower classes. You know, out into the jails, and people would sell themselves into 7 years of indentured slavery to get transportation to the New World. So I'm not saying that the majority of people who came, of the Europeans who came to America, were of the higher classes. I'm saying is that the leaders of America were of the higher classes. Some of them lost some of the best people in England. As opposed to Australia, where Australia started out as a penal colony. And the only leaders there were those who were there to keep the criminals. And that's why Australia came along, I think, in some ways late in developing a penal colony civilization. Yes.
One of the reasons that maybe we got some of the good people, I'm wondering is it because it was hard for them to get out and you had to have a certain status?
Well, you had to have money for one thing to travel.
To leave.
You had to have money to travel. And you had to have the courage to do it and the reason. And people who are very uneducated often don't. They're too afraid to get out and do it. Mm-hmm. So they were people of means, of education, of integrity, and of courage. Which is not bad stuff to start a new country.
Was it hard for them to get out?
Yes.
Militarily?
Yeah, and out of France, they had to sneak.
Let me ask you a question. Why would they want to keep them in if they didn't want them? Why not send them all over to America?
Because, remember John Calvin? John Calvin, his thinking was having a great impact even in France. They didn't want them leaving and then. But their influence continuing from outside the country, they don't get rid of them.
But if they shipped them off to America, they wouldn't have to worry about them, would they?
Well, yes, they would.
Why?
Because of family ties, of communications,
the ideas would cross the borders as they have at John Calvin.
You said that one of the reasons that the ones that came to America were higher status because they were all Protestants?
They weren't all Protestants. I'm saying many of them were. They were some of the best people. One of the reasons they wanted to keep men was they had the money. So many of the people who had money, had capital, were leaving, and they wanted to keep men. Why does Russia want to keep the Jews in? They want to go to Israel, I'll let them go. The answer is that they represent, not just the image, if Russia's image would suffer, these people have talents, skills, means that they want to keep. Why was the Berlin Wall put up? Look at the Berlin Wall and see which side the mines are on, which side has the barbed wire. You see, the Berliners, the Russians, the communists put up the Berlin Wall. What they said was, is to keep the undesirables out, which is ridiculous because they put all the landmines and the barbed wire on their side. It's on their side. Why? Because that wasn't why the Berlin Wall was put up. It was put up to keep people in. Why would they want to keep people in? Because you see, Germany, East Germany, if they had not put up that Berlin Wall, would have lost. They lost so many of their best people to West Germany. They just pulled out by the thousands. People with the doctors, the professional class, the college professors, the school teachers, people with money. They were leaving Germany by the thousands. Any way they could get out. That's why the Berlin Wall was put up. One of the reasons why in Miami, the first generation of Cubans who came when Castro took over were people of stature, people who improved the community, who improved neighborhoods, who did not contribute to juvenile delinquency, to the crime problem, because they were the best people. The professional class, you know, the people who had, and the best people left Cuba and came to America. People think, you know, badly, but the first bunch, it wasn't like that at all. You understand that? Because this is the nature of this thing. What happened in France? And this is the beginning of America. And it helps us understand some of the sentiments which were expressed in the founding documents of our country. Okay, let's move on. Let me look at this paragraph. The period of repression, 1685 to 1789, terrible. Repression continued until after the French Revolution and the reign of Napoleon. It's a long time. Look at that. How many years between 1685 and 1789? How many years is that? Yeah, it's almost a century. For a century, think about that. The Protestantism in France was cruelly suppressed, repressed, for a century. Only then did after the French Revolution did the Huguenots enjoy some toleration, as misspelled. Because of the extended persecution and repression, the Protestant faith is comparatively weak in France. The Protestantism is still weak in France. Why? Because they simply were killed. Think of that. What percentage of the population was Protestant? 1/10, a tithe of the people. The Reformed Church in France, look at this statement, underline this, has been called the Church of the Cross. Some have said that no church in any other country has suffered as did the Huguenots in France. In fact, it has been suggested that the persecution of the Huguenots in France was in many cases worse, in many ways, especially in numbers, worse than the persecution of the first century and second century and third century church by the Roman government. Modern France is not proud of what it did to the Huguenots. And they have no reason to be proud. Some of the stories, the heroism. Read Fox's Book of Martyrs. I can tell you stories that make you so you couldn't eat your lunch. Some of the great
If you read these stories, which I've done, some of the greatest martyrs, some of those who stood with the greatest courage were the women. Some of the greatest women in the history of Christianity died for their faith in France. Many of the stories have come down to us, the accounts of tremendous faith and courage. Well, we come now to the Reform movement in the Netherlands. Before our break, let's remind ourselves of the setting. The Netherlands included Belgium and Holland. All this area in here that has been divided since.
Yeah, let's use this map. Here it is.
This is Spanish Netherlands, this is Belgium here now, and Holland. This is the Netherlands. Why is it called the Netherlands?
The same reason that northern Germany was called Transylvania, Latin for across through the woods.
Then what does the Netherlands mean? It doesn't cost anything. But what was the point of, what does nether mean?
Away, farthest away.
It's an old term. The netherest was the farthest away. What was the point of farthest away from what? What's the point of reference?
Rome.
Farthest away from Rome.
Here's the point of reference. Netherlands, you have this?
Farthest away from Rome on the European continent. That's what it means. See, you learned something today.
And it was ruled by Spain, the most powerful country during part of this period. What was the policy of the Spanish rulers? Charles V, remember him? 30 years more? He was succeeded by his son, Philip II, and Philip was a fanatical Roman Catholic, and he established a cruel policy toward Protestantism in the Netherlands. He found Spain controlled this, and Protestantism had taken root and grown there, and just as in France, Philip said, I'm going to get rid of this business. The Duke of Alba, who was the regent, we would call legate, if you go by that title, the Duke of Alba was the Spaniard who represented the Spanish government in the Netherlands. And so Philip II in Spain made the policies. The Duke of Alba carried them out. You go to modern Holland and you want to insult somebody, the Duke of Alba has become a cuss word in Holland. Kind of like Hitler. He was not well loved in the history of Holland. Well, in the political realm, the policy was to crush the freedom of the Netherlands. Why? Because the Netherlands were beginning to become independent. They wanted to be independent, kind of like the Swiss in some ways, and Spain was not going to have that, so it was a political repression. The policy was to bleed the Netherlands for the benefit of Spain. Spain needed cash to fight its wars with England and France. And so they were going to simply use the Netherlands as a source for capital, bleed them dry. And the religious policy was simply to crush Protestantism at any cost. The problem was that the Holland of the Netherlands was one of the places that people fled to from their home, the Protestants fled to. Everybody was in Holland. Holland, why? Up until this time, I'll learn this, then we'll take our break. Up until this time, Holland was the most enlightened. Holland was a place where there was more intellectual freedom than there was any place else in Europe. The great Erasmus, we're going to meet later, was from Rotterdam. Interestingly enough, Holland at one time became the leading port. Holland today, by the way, in